This week, the precious metals ended up at the highest point in nearly 2 months. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczyk, here with you. We've got another big show for you this weekend with top interviews from your favorite industry professionals, as well as the financial market headlines. Wall Street legend Peter Leides joins the show. He says U.S. stocks are overvalued, making the call well before the Friday sell-off. Fixed income investors have been forced, he says, to chase dividend yields, and unfortunately, it just won't end well. We could see something similar to the year 2008 sell-off, or something even worse, like the 2000 sell-off. Worst case scenario? Well, forecasts you have to take sometimes with a boulder of salt, but he thinks that we could see something rivaling even the 1929-1932 deluge. Next up, John Williams from ShadowStats, a rogue economist who says the U.S. dollar rally will fade. Interestingly, again, he also called that before this Friday, and he says the world is in a recession, and the U.S. economy, although one of the strongest economies, is still stagnant. Once the false rally loses steam, he thinks the greenback will drop. You'll see sudden hyperinflation. And what are his major gold forecasts? Well, they're so fantastic. I'm going to let you listen to the interview and find out for yourself. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Sunny skies persisted over the gold market this week. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the yellow metal was up about $30, 2.5%, finishing at $12.22 an ounce. Silver picked up 75 cents, nearly 5%, ending at $17.03, well off of its $14 lows. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index, though, was up about 2%, closing at $68.68. Palladium added $12.70, ending at $8.14, while platinum picked up $4, finishing at $12.27 an ounce. West Texas Intermediate crude dropped $8 off $12.50 for the week, finishing at an unbelievable $57.49. One of the top stories affecting the market this week, plunging price of oil, as I mentioned, combined with the stock market sell-off. West Texas Intermediate crude down about 50% lower from that $105 peak from earlier this year. And the CRB Commodities Index is moving virtually in lockstep with crude oil. Add to the fray the stock market deluge, and it appears that traders might be expecting something from the Fed next week, perhaps a change in guidance and interest rates, as soon as the next FOMC meeting slated for December 16th and 17th. Turning to the economic news, the Thomson Reuters University of Michigan preliminary December index of consumer sentiment increased to 93.8 from 88.8, an incredible rise. Retail sales in November reached the highest point in 8 months, while unemployment is, of course, at one of the best levels in years. Bottom line, we just see unbelievably robust economic figures. This likely gives the Fed governors some wiggle room needed to change their policy regarding the benchmark lending rate. And that, of course, makes many traders nervous because it's been essentially the liquidity punch bowl on the Wall Street Exchange floor, keeping, well, all the cogs nicely oiled and moving smoothly. Precious metals bottom line. Well, although the U.S. dollar finally lost some upward momentum after months of a near vertical ascent, it's been said price has memory. Investors certainly do have memory about prices, and the U.S. dollar did fail to break through solid resistance, and that was set back in 2008. So for the time being, the gold and silver markets are treading water. I think it's advisable to wait for the XAU to show more signs of life, and I'd like to see how all the markets react to next week's FOMC meeting. And moving on to the Wall Street Report, cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange. U.S. equities indexes snapped a 7-week winning streak, ending with the biggest weekly decline in several years. The Dow lost 677 points, 3.8%, finishing at 17,958, recoiling from a recent close that was the highest in national history. The S&P 500 dropped 73, finishing at 2,002, while the NASDAQ dropped 127 points, 2.66%, finishing at 4,740. The unprecedented drop in oil prices, I think, presents an interesting dichotomy. Lower energy prices puts extra income in every American's pocket. It lowers corporate expenses, encourages spending. On the other hand, lower crude oil prices tends to coincide with major economic contractions. Think back to the 2007-2008 credit crisis. This indicates that fewer consumers are spending and working, while industrial output is also contracting, particularly in China, which just announced lower than anticipated economic conditions, as well as Japan and the EU, where economic output has been sluggish for some time. So bottom line on Wall Street, well, our trusty 7 indicator reached an extreme fear level this week on selling, and this is a very positive sign. I would expect the market to stabilize next week following the FOMC meeting. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with John Williams from ShadowStats.com and Peter Eliades. Stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Thanks for joining us for another GoldSeek.com radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, John Williams from ShadowStats.com. Welcome, John Williams.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Just start off here with developments in recent months since we last had you on the broadcast. Yeah, we've seen a broad-based rally in the U.S. dollar relative to the euro. How does this factor into your analysis? It certainly would appear, on the one hand, to be at least disinflationary, but my guess is that this is, from your perspective, just an anomaly.
Well, an anomaly would be the way I would view it. Indeed, if the dollar strength continued, it would be deflationary, but it certainly would tend to depress inflation rates. The only thing that you have in the way of deflation, or had in recent years, was back a couple of years as everything was gyrating following the panic in 2008. And you had oil prices way up and oil prices way down, and if you get a big collapse in oil prices as we just did. Which is also tied to the strength in the dollar. The dollar pretty much drives the oil prices. There's a lot of other factors involving oil prices, but the fact that oil prices right now are low is largely due to the relative strength in the dollar. That brings down gasoline prices, and the gasoline prices are probably as an important factor as you have in the consumer price index, so that in an official reporting, as you had the gasoline prices falling back in, that was 2009, 2010, we had a little bit of official deflation as measured by the consumer price index. However, the consumer price index is some percentage points shy of reality, and I'll contend that if you looked at inflation the way that people used to, that we never really had that shallow deflation. But deflation's not the big issue here, although there are some people that are concerned about a 1930s style deflation, where you had a collapse of the banking system. I think it's going to go the other way, that we're going to have, I'm still looking for a hyperinflation, but coincident with that will be weakness in the dollar, which again gets back to your opening question. Let's look at the dollar a minute. Its strength here against the European currencies, the big European currencies and the yen, is based on several factors that I don't think are going to last and can turn very sharply in terms of market perceptions. Number one is relative economic strength. You look at the rest of the world, it's in recession. You look at our GDP reporting, it looks like we're seeing a booming economy. In fact, the economy that we have seen reported the last two quarters, we're at 4.6% in the third quarter GDP and 4.6 in the second quarter GDP, 3.9% in the third quarter. We haven't seen growth like that since 2003. This is the strongest economy we've seen in a decade, if you can believe the government's numbers. I don't know anyone who's looking at this as the strongest economy in the last decade in terms of real business activity, but that's how silly the GDP number has gotten. If you look at the GDP or the broad economy as, let's say, measured by the revenues, the sales of the S&P 500 companies, and adjusted for CPI inflation and adjusted for stock buybacks, that you're looking at effectively year-to-year sales, aggregate sales net of inflation, the third quarter contracted, and the economy has been flat for a couple of years. That's per the S&P 500. We haven't seen a booming economy there, and you would rarely see a flat revenues in the major corporate America with the economy supported supposedly booming along at a decade high levels.
New nominal all-time record highs, 117-year high for the Dow Jones Industrials. In its history, never seen anything near 18,000. You're citing buybacks and mergers and things of that nature being a primary component driving demand and absorbing a lot of the supply of shares. That, of course, is helping to catapult equities to new highs, despite the fact that our economic growth is not nearly as robust as our officials would have us believe. Is that a fair assessment?
I mean, the stock prices are at an all-time high. I've got serious problems with where the stock market is, and I don't have a real happy forecast as to where it's going to go. What I'm talking about are the sales of the large companies that compose the stock indices, the S&P 500. You have 500 companies that make up that index. These are large corporations across the board of industries. And what I'm saying is, if you look at their sales, the level of business activity, the level of business activity is not measured by stock prices. It's measured by revenues. So the level of what are you actually selling out there? And if you adjust it for inflation, using the government's consumer price index, what you're seeing is that the level of sales of the S&P 500 actually declined in the third quarter. We didn't have an economic surge. We haven't had an economic surge in the sales of the 500 large companies that are in the Standard & Poor's Index. What we've seen is that when you adjust for inflation, their sales level has basically been flat, and it turned down in the third quarter. What I'm saying is that the growth in the economy that's been reported is inconsistent with that. Stock prices are inconsistent with reality as well, and indeed the buybacks do all sorts of things in helping to promote the stock market, as has Fed policy. We can get to the stock market later if you want, but right now what I'm looking at is just a couple of measures of the economy that are suggesting that what we're getting with the GDP is not real. You look at the election, for example. Normally, when pocketbook issues are a big deal, the elections go against the incumbent party in the White House. That's what happened here. If you look at the exit polling as to how people viewed the economy, you had only 26% of the voters indicate that the economy was good or excellent. If you look at that historically, that's consistent with a contracting economy, not a booming economy. An average economy, which would be somewhat shy of 3%, you would have gotten a reading there of about 50%, but down at 26%. And the reality is we're seeing a contracting economy. We're seeing a recession as well as the rest of the world, which is one reason that people begin to recognize that and the numbers turn down in this post-election period. that you're going to see some selling pressure return against the dollar, because relative economic strength is a big factor. And we're in recession. It's demonstrable. People go to my site and look in the upper right-hand corner. There's a copies of the hyperinflation report. The second installment shows you how the economics series, the GDP series, have been played with. They use too low a rate of inflation in reporting the GDP, and that has the effect of spiking the GDP growth. You take out the bad inflation adjustments, and you'll find that what the GDP has shown, instead of collapsing into 2009 and then just rebounding, and right now it's just it's rebounding and expanding, and again expanding at a pace not seen in 10 years, it collapsed and then basically was stagnant and has been bottom bouncing ever since. That's what you see with the Standard & Poor's. That's what you see with the voting indications. That's what you see with the consumer confidence measures. That's what you see with the housing starts. You take look at factors that have inflation taken out of them. You'll see that the economy has not recovered. Second big point with the dollar is related directly to the economy, because the one of the factors here that triggered the early dollar rally, a very deliberate effort here, was the a pullback by the Fed in its quantitative easing. Three, it stopped purchasing net new issuance of treasury bills or notes or bonds. It's keeping its levels constant, but it's not increasing them. Well, what you're seeing in the rest of the world is a lot of noise, and the Japanese have actually done some things, a lot of noise out of Europe that, oh, yes, we're going to debase our currency, too, and where it looks like all of a sudden the Fed is being unusually prudent, and the rest of the world is debasing their currencies all over the place. That's a good reason for moving into the dollar. My contention is that what's happening with the Fed, it was more orchestrated than anything else for giving us the dollar that we're seeing today. I think part of this is all aimed at putting financial stress on the Russians, a covert economic financial war.
Obviously, crude oil, a huge component of their economic engine, if not the key component. So by having dollar strength, as you alluded to earlier, that, of course, crushes crude oil prices, and we've seen just the biggest decimation since 2008.
As it becomes recognized that our economy is not recovering, not only is not recovering, that it hasn't recovered, or it's heading, that maybe the best we're going to get in the way of the reporting in terms of anything close to accuracy or what people are commonly experiencing will be that the economy is turning down again. Speculation will mount, okay, the Fed's got to come back in and provide liquidity to the system and work to debase the dollar again. That's the big reason that you would see such a shift in the dollar if it looks like the U.S. is in recession again and not booming along. Third area is in the realm of political stability. Big factor if you look at the relative political stability in one country versus another in their currencies. Good measure for that, I found historically, has been the popularity rating of the president, or the positive rating. What we're seeing now is at an all-time low. Normally that would be in an environment where you had a very weak U.S. dollar. You have other factors at play here, too. Our trade deficit is widening again, despite expectations that it would narrow with the lower oil prices. What you have to do from an economic standpoint is look at the what's happening with the trade net of inflation. That's how they view the GDP. This will be a negative factor in the fourth quarter GDP because the fourth quarter trade is widening versus the third quarter trade, but it's doing that even before inflation adjustment. Relative trade is a big factor, just basic flow of currencies back and forth with trade. We have a number of factors there that suggest you have a weak dollar ahead. I'm not only looking for a weak dollar, but because the dollar is so far removed from reality at this point that you're going to have a very sharp downside adjustment. There may be currency interventions, all sorts of things that the government will try. what the Fed would need to do if it wanted to fundamentally prop up the dollar would be to raise interest rates. But it's not about to do that because that would kill the stock market and the bond market. So they're back in a conundrum of choices. But the bottom line here is that the dollar is going to go lower, and with it, our inflation risks will start to rise rather rapidly. And if you have a panic decline or massive selling of the dollar, as I think will eventually unfold here, you're going to see a very sharp rise in a commodity-based inflation, which will provide a preliminary trigger for the hyperinflation.
Let's talk about interest rates. You alluded to the Fed low intentions of increasing rates because it would eviscerate the housing recovery, that nascent recovery. The Philadelphia Housing Index would likely implode, coinciding with the major equities bull rally. Before we get to stocks and housing, let's talk about the threat of interest rates. Right now, the general consensus, Bloomberg Online and some of the other media outlets, why do you think the FOMC won't raise rates? Or if they do, will it just be a token amount?
They're going to be forced into some kind of an easing again to not help the economy, although that's going to be how it's viewed by the public. It might be to help the stock market, but the primary function of the Fed here is to keep the banking system afloat. And if the economy is not recovering, if it's indeed in recession, new recession, deepening recession, however you want to qualify it, that means more financial stress for the banking system. The Fed's got to provide liquidity to the banking system. That's what it did with its quantitative easing. Its quantitative easing did very little to help the domestic economy. The low interest rates helped the banks to make a lot of risk-free income. But the issue here is whether or not they're going to have to keep funding the banks, and the problem, the answer there is going to be yes. And if you look at the federal government, where the cash deficit was order of magnitude $500 billion last year, that's about what the Federal Reserve actually bought in treasuries in the same period. The Fed actually effectively monetized last year's federal budget deficit. That's a very bad sign. That's very inflationary. That's direct monetization of the debt. That's where eventually you go when the government can no longer raise the funds it needs to cover its obligations. You wouldn't think they were there yet, but you could make a pretty good case that the Fed thought they were there yet, given that they were there now, but given the way they've handled this. But the effect there, assuming they start buying treasuries again, will be to support the treasury. It'll be to support the banking system, not the economy. They know there's nothing they can do, really, that'll help the economy. They've said that. They're very open about it. They use guidelines in terms of, maybe we'll look at this or that if the economy does this. But they can't make they cannot take action now that will help the economy. All their bullets have been fired. It's beyond control. So what they'll do, where the economy comes in, is it needing to provide liquidity to the banking system in particular. As the economy weakens, indeed they're going to find ways of putting more liquidity into the system. They're going to blame the economy. The economy is the political cover for them. If they tell the public we're doing this to bail out the banking system, that's not going to be politically popular. But if they say, oh, no, the economy's weak, we've got to do this again, that's an easy sell. So right now the Wall Street, the happy story is, oh, the Fed's being virtuous and the economy's so strong they're going to have to raise interest rates next year. The Fed's going to have to raise interest rates next year because they're so virtuous and the economy's strong. That argument's going to disappear pretty quickly. Are interest rates going to go higher? Yes, they have to, eventually. I mean, it's a matter of the Fed can keep buying up the treasuries and keep rates artificially low, but at some point the markets look at this and again they worry about hyperinflation. They say, where's this going? You just don't want to hold the treasuries, and the only people buying the treasuries sit on the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee. There will be a process there that will move interest rates higher. Normally, long-term interest rates would write about 3% above the inflation rate, order of magnitude. 2%, so long-term interest rate should be up about 5%. Right now, you're still in a situation where you're looking at negative real interest rates at the short end of the curve. It's cheaper for people make more money to go out and buy the goods that are going to be inflated and hold them and make money because those goods are going up in value, than to put their money in a treasury bill, which is still viewed as the risk-free investment vehicle.
When one reviews any of the hyperinflationary episodes throughout history, prices increased at a galloping pace. Many merchants became wealthy, just buying, holding on, and then eventually they were ostracized and vilified and accused of stockpiling against the better interest of society. Do you see something like that on the horizon?
Well, if you're going to have a stable circumstance, possibly, but here again, I think eventually you're going to see that the prices are just going to start taking off, and when they do, the people are going to be more concerned about being able to get product and being able to afford it. You're going to have all sorts of problems with this, but just to finish up with the Fed and inflation rates, higher interest rates are actually better for the economy. This low interest rate spiel is basically a banker's game. Low interest rates kill retired people who like to put their savings in something that's safe where they can get a stable return, like maybe get a CD with 4 or 5% interest rate on it, FDIC insured, or treasury bills that will give you a return that will beat the rate of inflation. When you get retired, you don't want to start putting your money in speculative investments, because that's the only way you can get a return on your money. There's no way you can get a safe return on your money in the United States today because of the Fed's interest rate policies. If interest rates are higher, guess what? Banks then have a little greater a profit margin, and it enables them to make loans with a little higher degree of risk, and they'll lend to people who are a little less creditworthy, with the effect that it stimulates economic activity. What the Fed's doing with its low interest rates helps the banks. It kills retirees, people who are living on savings, and it actually is detrimental to economic activity. But that's not their concern. Their concern is to keep the banking system afloat.
You know, there's a mountain of notional credit derivatives. Huge component of that has interest rate exposure. Some estimates show higher than $1 quadrillion on a worldwide basis. The deflation camp is quite concerned that within the next few years, deleveraging of much of that debt could have a similar impact on the global economy as the 1930s depression.
What happened in the 1930s was you had a collapse in the banking system. People actually lost their the money they had in the banks. And as that happened, you saw the money supply evaporate. Money supply contracted about a third. Deflation was actually down by a third. That all required a collapse in the banking system, a collapse in the money supply. If you have highly leveraged derivatives, the notional values, that's an extraordinarily high number, but again, in theory, there's not the exposure is there. Small percentages of that. The fear here would be that it would collapse the banking system. That's where we were back in 2008. Could the banking system collapse? Yeah, it probably could. And if nothing were done, would it have collapsed in 2008? Yep, probably would have. But what you saw happen then was the Fed did everything it could, along with the Treasury. Irrespective of long-term consequence of the action, they guaranteed all deposits. They created whatever money they had to. They bailed out whatever institutions they had to. As long as they can create the money, they can bail out the institutions. The question is what the currency becomes worth as they do all this. They've gotten through the initial 2008 panic without without a hyperinflation, and again, they did a number of things to keep the banks afloat without pumping up the money supply as it normally would be pumped up. We're coming up to the second stage of the 2008 collapse. Maybe it'll come in the derivatives. I think it could just happen with the weakness in the system as it still exists. Everything that they did in 2008 to salvage the system, to keep it from collapsing, was temporary. Just push things into the future. The banks are still in trouble. The economy is still in trouble. We get to this next crisis, which could be triggered by the dollar or ongoing weakness in the economy, problems in the derivatives. There's speculation as to how they address it. But again, I would expect that the powers that be would do whatever that was in their power to prevent the banking system from collapsing.
Do you talk about how the powers that be and our officials, by using this neo-Keynesian model, they are keeping the economy afloat until a later time when normal or more normal economic conditions return to help support and pull us out of the mire? Things aren't the same, that we're not as economically viable as, let's say, the 1970s or even the early 1980s, that our industrial base has been eviscerated and these methods they're using will no longer have the same panacea-like effect on the economy.
I mean, what you say, I think a lot of people are looking at, we're just in a holding pattern here till things come back. It's going to be decades before this economy comes back. The economy, there's no basis here for the economy to move forward. And the people in Washington know this. It's a circumstance where what they did back in 2008 was not just buying time. It was, we just got to stop the collapse at this point in time, whatever the cost. They didn't do anything fundamentally to improve the system. They just bought time. They didn't know what to do. It's beyond their control. There's nothing much that they can do to stabilize things, to get the economy growing. I mean, if you look at the economy, the issues here are long-term, and certainly not in a circumstance where you have politicians in Washington either in the White House and or in Congress to look at moving things around. Look at the consumer. Median household income. What's a middle household doing in terms of its aggregate income? Adjusted for the government's CPI inflation, not my inflation, which is a bigger amount, would show a weaker economy. But just the headline numbers. You're looking at a situation where income today is below where it was in the late 60s, early 1970s. That's for a household. It had picked up in the late 1990s and then started coming down in the 2000s. And when the starting to fall off, as the economy was falling off in 2008, but when the economy rebounded in 2009, it just collapsed. That's something that clearly shows that the economy did not recover. You say, what's happening here? The problem is that incomes are not growing as fast as inflation, even the headline inflation. And the reason for that is that a lot of the higher-paying jobs have been lost to offshore competition. Our trade deficit started to balloon back in the 1970s, and as the higher-paying jobs are lost to and the various trade deals, that brought down the average share of the median household incomes, and the consumer just has never recovered. Now, Greenspan, and he was Fed chairman, he came in 87 and helped trigger the stock market crash by raising interest rates in September of that year, and then as the market crashed, his way of saving the stock market was, aside from intervention by the New York Fed buying stocks the second day, was we'll just abandon the dollar here. Don't worry about the dollar. We'll save stocks. And that's been a common approach. Forget the dollar. Forget the budget deficit. You know, those don't have any political import. And you saw a general debasement of the dollar, a general debasement of the U.S. fiscal circumstance. But as it became obvious that the consumer was suffering more and more in terms of his real income, disposable income, Greenspan realized that there's no way to support an ongoing healthy growth in the economy with the consumer and those trade patterns. And what the Fed did at that time was to encourage people to expand debt. If you can't buy it cover your cost of living with your income because your income is dropping relative to your cost of living, you can make up the difference through debt expansion. Usually the idea is it's a temporary makeup, but the Fed encouraged debt expansion and debt leverage built upon debt leverage, and that's what gave us the debt bubble coming into 2008. But it also provided most of the growth seen in the economy for the decade before that. As we hit the 2008 panic, the debt collapse, all of a sudden the consumer still didn't have income growth, now couldn't increase his or her debt meaningfully in order to make up for the income shortfall. And the economy continued to fall off as a result. Consumer funds about 72% of economic activity is measured by the GDP. So the consumer doesn't have the ability to expand consumption. There's no way the economy's going to grow. Not going to happen. So there's no big economic boom in the future here unless we get the trade picture turned around, unless you get people making more basic income. A lot of things have to be done to the economy before that would happen. Not going to happen. So what I see happening here very simply is that you're going to have another 2008-like panic. They're going to do whatever they can, but they're not going to get the support of the world in terms of buying the dollar again as they did back in 2008. The dollar will plummet. As the world runs away from the dollar, so will the Americans. You're going to have a tremendous financial crisis here. You're going to end up with the dollar, as we know it, domestically becoming worthless, hyperinflation. So for what investors do, if you live in the United States and your world is denominated in U.S. dollars, you do well to cover at least some of your assets and wealth with physical gold, because the gold will preserve the purchasing power of those assets, get you through the worst of the economic times in a position of having liquidity and having maintained the value of your assets. That's what it's used for here. I mean, the price of gold has been up and down with all sorts of manipulations and with the recent manipulations of the dollar. But I don't care if you get it at $1,000 an ounce, $2,000 an ounce, $5,000 an ounce. When you see the inflation kick in, and the inflation will get worse and worse, you'll see gold at $100,000 an ounce. And there'll be people say, oh, boy, you know, I've made a lot of money here. I'm going to cash out. That's not the purpose of holding the gold. All you've done is you've maintained the purchasing power of the money, the assets that you put into gold. If you liquidate them before the currency system has run its course and the inflation, it'll just become whatever you end up with will become worthless as well if it's dollar denominated from a paper standpoint. It's not a hard asset. So that I look at the precious metals, again, physically holding the precious metals, as the ultimate hedge against the worst of times, against the U.S. dollar, horrible financial circumstances, a way of preserving wealth through difficult times and surviving on the other side of the crisis.
Sure, the listeners would like to hear your thoughts about this equities rally. By some metrics, frothy relative to, let's say, the year 1999-2000 epoch where we saw particularly the NASDAQ blow off top. Now we're seeing many components of the Dow Jones, for instance, and the S&P, as well as the NASDAQ and the Russell, almost parabolic and in some cases straight up on weekly and monthly charts. If history is a guide, we see a tendency for prices to revert to the mean.
There's no way we're seeing anything close to a normal economy, financial system, or stock market. What you're seeing in the stock market's been heavily manipulated, played with. I'd avoid it. It's not, I can tell you I'm not a stock picker analyst. I'm certainly not into day-to-day timing of things. But what I can give you is a rough thing to look at here. The stock market falls into trouble. And you may, I mean, I wouldn't, I'll just give you a scenario that might happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but the ultimate thing here is to look at where it ends up. Let's say I'm right on the dollar, and the economy falters. The Fed begins to ease again, possibly to prop up stocks. And certainly, they've done that before to prop up the stock market. So the economy falters, the stocks start to fall off, the dollar weakens, the Fed comes in and it starts to ease again, intensifying the dollar sell-off, but it rallies the stocks. Stocks go to new highs. I would, under that type of a circumstance, I would urge whoever's looking at it to consider the value of those stocks as priced in terms of gold, in terms of Swiss francs, in times of net of U.S. inflation. And I think what you'll find is that the rallies there haven't been rallies when you look at it in constant dollar terms.
But these themes that we see developing in primary markets have a tendency to gain momentum and persist for years, even decades in some cases.
Well, again, that's all tied to the dollar. That's a transitory.
From your perspective, then, this huge shift that we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years will reverse course abruptly and lead us back into a new bull market?
Well, I wouldn't call it a bull market. Again, I'm looking at end times here in terms of the currency system as we know it. I mean, you'll see this happening with anything that right now globally is priced in dollars, such as oil. The dollar sells off sharply. Oil prices in dollar terms is going to rise sharply. That will become very inflationary in the United States. Other dollar-denominated commodities will tend to rise as well. Now, if they're not dollar-denominated, assuming the dollar is selling off here, which I fully expect it will, I mean, that's preconditioned effectively, it'll be even more inflationary in terms of how you see the price. In fact, in the United States, in U.S. dollar terms, prices will be going higher. Now, but that'll be in something that'll be beyond control. I would not. I'd just batten down the hatches, hang on to my gold, and let the system run its course and crash. I mean, it's not a stable circumstance. I wouldn't want to bet on stability of financial markets, even a domestic distribution of goods and services in a hyperinflation. It's going to be a very unusual time. You can't call exactly what's going to happen. There are all sorts of things that can happen, but I wouldn't be speculating too much in terms of commodity prices or stock prices outside of the basic holdings of stuff that I needed for myself. Were in terms of commodities such as gold and silver, physically holding the gold. I mean, if you have the someone's holding a gold certificate for you in Chicago, and you need the gold because you're going to use it to do whatever. It'd be a lot easier if you had the physical gold in hand than a piece of paper. You don't know what's going to happen within the system. So you want to just be as conservative and as self-sufficient as possible. In fact, I would look at a circumstance here where it probably makes sense to treat what's going to happen to the dollar as a natural disaster or a man-made disaster. Again, I'm out in California sitting on a major earthquake fault. I'm not here because I want to be here. I mean, I'm with family and I'm going to get out of this general area from the standpoint of what could happen with a natural disaster. But you have to be prepared. You don't know when it's going to hit. And so people out here stock up with food and water to get them through a certain period of time. If you look at a crisis with the dollar, in terms of the purchasing power of the currency, you might well be in a circumstance where maybe the you're going to have some distribution and distribution disruptions where goods don't get to a grocery store. That's a good way for panics to start. But if you have food and water, the basic necessities that you need to get by for a couple of months, A, you survive, and B, you have barterable goods for what probably would be an interim stage of economic or currency activity before a new system, currency system, was set up. The dollar as we know it, I just don't see surviving. I can't tell you how long it will be before. But if you have, if you're holding gold to get you through the system financially, you need a backup of basic goods that will keep you alive and comfortable as well.
I wonder if you might outline what you see as an end game unfolding with the U.S. dollar. You know, keeping with the earthquake metaphor, do you see a revaluation or a sudden Cyprus moment?
I'm happy to address that general area, but the thing is, you don't know how it's going to break. There are any number of ways it can break. What I can tell you that is a virtual certainty here is that the dollar, as we know it, does not survive, that it will become worthless. There'll be currency crisis, there'll be hyperinflation. How it goes from there, how things go politically. I mean, you get your money out of the bank and the money's not worth anything, it doesn't make any difference.
The FOMC, the Federal Reserve, they're an awfully tenacious group. The Fed has managed to live past 100 years of age. If history is a guide, we'll pull out every stop imaginable just to keep the House of Cards from imploding, keep the music going.
I'm sure they will. And in fact, 100 years, you know, that's almost the amount of purchasing power of the dollar that's disappeared, the Fed was created, I think you're down 98%. But, of course, that 2% is what we're living with today. If you'd had your money in gold back in 1914, you'd be in a little better shape. The thing is that, yes, they're going to do everything that they can, but they're not magicians. There's certain things that you can do with the system and certain things that you can't. They came up to the limits there. We had, with everything that was done, particularly since 2004, in the terms of the federal government's obligations, all the Fed has done to keep the banking system, financial system afloat with this extraordinary leverage, build upon leverage, and all these derivative instruments, build upon derivative instruments. There's when you come down to the end, there's a day of reckoning. We had that day of reckoning back in 2008. But they said, no, we're not going to accept this. We're going to do everything we can to keep the system from collapsing. And they did. But there was nothing much they could do to resolve the problems. All they could do is paper over some of them and push them into the future. We're at that future now. We're not far from this breaking open again as a continuation of 2008. But they no longer have all the options that they had. I think what's going to be obvious here is that increasingly the rest of the world is not going to be sitting by and saying, okay, United States, we're going to give you another chance here to work this out over the next 5 to 10 years. The rest of the world's going to start saying, okay, U.S., you're on your own. We're dumping the dollar and we're moving ahead without you. The big problem is the United States and the extraordinary excesses that we've put into it, the system in terms of debt and leverage and fiscal improprieties going into the future, where we have right now net present value of what the government needs in hand today to cover its obligations that it's committed to is $100 trillion, five times the GDP. There's no way that can be covered. Eventually, and the rest of the world knows it, the U.S. has to either really get its house in fiscal order, which is not politically possible in the current circumstance, or the dollar is going to become worthless. And it's a matter of when people start bailing out of the dollar. You'd have another 2008 crisis.
There are many investors and traders listening to your voice today. Give people an idea of some of the smoke they should be watching for on the horizon. For instance, you would see signs like the U.S. equities market rolling over, as we saw circa 2007. You'd see the U.S. dollar meandering near a bottom, not breaking out to new highs. So certainly the markets are discounting everything that you have outlined here today. We wouldn't be expecting an implosion by, let's say, 2015.
If the markets were anticipating what I'm outlining today, we'd be in a hyperinflation. They're not discounting it. Forget the U.S. equities. That's really more of a derivative market here to the other factors. The key right now is the U.S. dollar and how it's being viewed by the rest of the world, how it's being held by the rest of the world. That's the crux of the issue. What I think you're going to see, rather than a smooth transition here to a weaker dollar, it's going to be some kind of a shock to the system that will create a dollar panic, a massive sell-off in the dollar. It's one that the Fed will probably, most likely, would respond to try and prop it up, most likely with intervention. I don't think they're going to spike interest rates, which would be a traditional defense against a weak currency, because of the other implications that would have for the domestic financial market. Intervention does not have lasting impact. The thing to look at here, what I'm looking for, sharp turn in the dollar, and one that very rapidly evolves into a massive sell-off. And that starts to happen, everything else that I'm talking about will start to fall into place. Again, if things may be done to rally stocks, but I would look at stocks in terms of the real purchasing power. What is it worth in terms of real money such as gold? Are you better holding the gold than the stocks? I have to go back and look at the numbers, but I think you go back to 2000, still did better buying gold than stocks. I'm talking here a long-term perspective, although I'm looking for a very short-term development that puts us in a very awkward situation that gets everything into play.
Oh, no, it's a basic calculation. I mean, gold is 4 to 5 times higher than the year 2000, whereas the Dow is not even 100% higher. Improvement in your assets by just simply holding gold over the past 15 years. So tell folks more about the services that you provide, please, at shadowstats.com.
We have, I put out a newsletter, a weekly commentary. Often there's more than one a week, depending upon economic releases. I assess the numbers as they're released and how they impact the broad picture. We do have also free on the site. That's generally in the upper right-hand column of the homepage. The hyperinflation reports, which detail the basics of what lies ahead, what I'm discussing here. And again, I'm not looking for a near-term happy play in the stock market. I'm looking at survival, and that's what I'm talking about here. This is not a normal, how's the next year going to go? This is when you want to be able to preserve your wealth and assets. That's all discussed here. There's a paper there that explains why the inflation is understated, as the government puts it out. Is it just in normal times? You look at the government's inflation rate and say, oh, that's interesting, inflation's 2%. Most people don't believe that. But if you're, and they're right, if you're looking at an inflation rate that covers the cost of living and maintaining a constant standard of living and reflecting what you're spending out of pocket, that's the way it used to be reported. If you want to have your salary adjusted in a manner that's consistent with maintaining a constant standard of living, if you want to look at an investment return that exceeds inflation on that basis, the problems with the inflation number and where some reality is all discussed there. But again, that's all updated weekly as circumstances change with the newsletter. We're always happy to get new subscribers. It's not very expensive, so if people have a chance to look at it, always welcome to our site. You don't have to put all your assets into gold, but view it as an insurance policy. Same thing with having some goods to keep you going if the grocery store gets shut down.
Now, that's such a good point. You know, just-in-time, remote areas in particular, the just-in-time, you know, method that they use to replenish grocery store shelves is certainly an issue. There is no stockpile in the back. It's not feasible anymore. It's not part of their business model. Most companies would go out of business if they kept large inventories on hand. So I think you make a great point. Plus, add in 50 million food stamp debit cards, and you certainly have the potential for a lot of upset and hungry folks on the horizon. John Williams, we want to thank you for your economic insight, sir.
Well, again, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, happy holidays from everyone at GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's special guest, Peter Eliades from Stock Market Cycles. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
I wonder if you could tell people your outlook on the equities markets. You know, it's been an interesting several years here, but once again, the market's showing incredible resiliency. Tell people what you see in the sector, please.
You know, I don't write my newsletter on a regular basis anymore, but what I do is I publish online reports, and we've attempted this year to try and publish online reports at in time zones where we thought, especially this year, that we, where the market was vulnerable. We've been fairly successful. Our last last report we wrote a week ago Friday and told people that once again we were cautious about the market. There's a real long-term channel. In fact, there are several channels, Chris, that go back, some of them to 2009 and some of them back to late 2011. And both the S&P and the Dow have been knocking around the top of those channels off and on during the year. Now, because they're rising channels, even if you hit the top of that channel, you have no guarantee that you have a final top because the channel's rising, and as you know, you can pull back from it 3, 5, 6, 7, even 10%, go back up to the top of the channel again. By that time, it's higher than it was before. So that's the kind of action that we've seen most of this year. We've seen the S&P, particularly the S&P that I follow very closely, going up to the channel, pulling back, having these small pullbacks, and then going up to the channel again. Right now, we are at the top of the channel once again. So whenever that happens, what I tell my people is I don't think the final very important high is necessarily in yet, but every time you hit the top of that channel line, because I do believe we are so incredibly overvalued, and we might discuss that in a moment too, but anytime we hit the top of that channel, that should be treated as potentially a very important market top. As I said, I don't think it's going to be the final top, but everyone should be treated as if it could be.
Overvaluation. I mean, we're certainly seeing signs of that cropping up. PEs are way beyond the typical. You might even say that it's reminiscent of circa 1999-2000. Some of our guests here on the show have commented that they think that it's worse, the lead-up to the dot-com implosion. Do you see any parallels?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think we have a parallel in the over-the-counter market because specifically at that time, it was just a craze that had gone on incredibly driving most of these tech stocks to incredible valuations. We see a glint of that in the tech stocks now, but what's happened is we see it in the overall market. And I try not to explain things in terms of fundamentals, Chris, because I'm very much a technician and I believe very much in psychoanalysis. Things that I'm watching in terms of the market now, in terms of sentiment, carelessness, people thinking that there's absolutely no vulnerability whatsoever. There's nothing to worry about. The Federal Reserve will take care of them. They'll bail them out if there are any problems. Yes, indeed, there are very close parallels. In fact, one can argue that the 2000 period was probably the only other time that was equally overvalued as the numbers that we see now. I don't look so much at PE ratios because they can be obscured by stocks that are reporting losses or earnings can be so volatile, Chris. What I look at, one of the most important things I look at is dividend yield. Now, the argument has been that the dividend yield is so low because interest rates are so low, and people are forced to go into the market to be speculative because there's no safe return that one can, let's say, a retirement-type person can get. It used to be you could get at least 4, 5, and 6% in terms of safe Treasury bills. Now that's out the window. So people are really being forced by artificially low interest rates to take that speculation and put their money in the market because it's the only hope they have of getting a return better than 2 or 3%. Ultimately, the price is going to be paid for that, and I can't promise anyone it's going to happen in the next few weeks, but I can almost promise people that it will happen in the next 6 to 8 months. Whether it extends out that long, I can't be sure, but there's going to be a very dear price to be paid.
A growing cadre of folks certainly share your sentiments with regard to the overextended nature of this advance. Do you see something on the horizon that might mirror what we saw in 2008, 2009? Could this be worse, or would it just be a road bump on the way to, I think it was Cadillac who wrote 24,000 Dow 20 years ago?
No, absolutely not. In terms of 24,000 Dow, I do not see something like that. Because of the fact that we're so overvalued right now at current levels. Listen, you and I know, Chris, that anything can happen in the stock market. You come up with a scenario that you think it has no chance in the world of occurring, and lo and behold, you turn around 6 months later and say, wow, that was, look what happened. So anything can happen in the markets, but the only thing we can base our judgments on is market history. And we have long history of the stock market, not just the Dow, which goes back about 115, 120 years now, but market indexes of, fortunately, because of the Foundation for the Study of Cycles, they provide us with United States security prices going all the way back to the late 1700s. So we know how prices have performed. We know what overvaluation is. And the thing that I look at, as I started to say, is dividend yield, because when push comes to shove, unless you're getting a real return in terms of dividends on your stock, then all the rest could be smoke and mirrors. When they give you a dividend, when a company gives you a dividend, that's in your pocket and they can never take it away from you. And that's where true valuation is. And when you see stock market indexes like the Dow and the S&P 500 reaching a dividend yield of at least 4, but perhaps more likely 5, 6, and 7%, which generally happens at important bear market bottoms, then you could be confident that we're looking at a market that has finally become undervalued and you see some value in. Now, mind you, to get from where we are now, which is a dividend yield under 2%, to try to get to one of 4, 5, and 6%, you can see that talks about at least a market decline of 50 and 60, 66 and two-thirds, which would be two-thirds of a withdrawal from the current levels of stock prices. And that's an incredibly bad thing. And that takes into consideration the fact that we still have the current number of dividends. You can rest assured that if stock prices start coming down really hard and there's a 50, 60, 70% decline, that those dividend yields will go down significantly too. And so that allows for an even greater decline. So if someone put my back to the wall and said, well, how far do you think the ultimate decline will be? I think it's going to be every bit as bad as the 07-09 decline, which was between 50 and 60% for most indexes. But I think there's a real chance, Chris, that we see a 1929 to 1932 type decline, which I think will surprise a lot of people.
It would catch most of these investors off guard, particularly when we read that many of those participating in this latest, you know, advance have far less experience under their belts than the last time around, the last big rallies. A little green and not prepared for what could happen for those contingencies in the market. As you say, everyone convinced the Fed will come to the rescue and save the day. Another sector, though, that our listeners are keen to hear your thoughts on, precious metal stocks have reached lows in many cases beyond that of 2000 and 2003, over a decade. Do you see any signs of a nadir in the market?
I don't have any strong feelings on the precious metals, although I do feel as if they are very much oversold. I don't think there's any question about that. So I think we could see a rally at any time and perhaps a surprisingly strong one. The problem that I have with the precious metals, though, is because I'm in the deflationist camp, Chris, is I think if truly we are going to face a deflation, which is not really helpful to almost anyone. Real estate will be going down. Stock prices will be going down. Precious metals may still be going down, depending on at what level they start from. I can't look at the precious metals currently and say, I think there's a great opportunity for a rally that's going to last a year or 2 years. I don't see that happening.
Any parting comments for our listeners today?
Just to be careful, because the sentiment numbers that we've read recently, a firm like Investors Intelligence, which has been around for over 50 years now, and the percentage of bears has been well under 15% for at least the last couple of months, and that doesn't guarantee a market top, but it tells you that you should be in the minority of those that are indeed watching for the possibility of a more significant market decline than almost anyone expects. I would tell people perhaps the most intelligent way of going about things now, Chris, would be, and I did this at the other market tops too in 2000 and 2007. I think what people would be well advised to do if they are in a stock portfolio is to look at their stocks and say, look, I hold XYZ stock at, let's say, a level of 50. I'm willing to ride it down 10% from here, but if it goes down more than that, I'm getting out. If you do that with your whole portfolio and put stop losses in, but make them trailing stop losses, the nice thing about that is if you're wrong about the vulnerability in the market, let's say that stock goes from 50 to 60, when it gets up to 60, then you adjust your stop underneath it for 10% under that. If you do that with all your stocks, you're never going to lose more than 10% in your overall portfolio, and you're ready to handle a market decline of significance. Now, obviously, the downside of that is people will say, well, you know, I had a stock at 50. I put the stop in at 45. That went down to 44.5, then went straight up to 60. It's not a risk-free procedure, but it's a procedure that will virtually assure you that you're not going to suffer a big loss in the market. And that's the big thing we have to be cautious of here.
It's excellent advice. You know, as Warren Buffett regularly points out, rule number one, don't lose capital. Rule number two, please refer to rule number one. And you're talking about protecting not only capital, but the wonderful profits that people have procured over this rally. Most important aspect of investing is protecting what you have and then letting your profits and winners run while not exposing too much of those profits. And we're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
It's nice to talk to you again, Chris. And people, as I said, it is online. So if they go to stockmarketcycles.com, they can find the latest report there.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. There's a saying that's often invoked when things are looking bleak or uncertain. People will say, as sure as the sun is going to rise, and then attach a statement to that sentence that supports something they want to happen, either out of necessity, pleasure, or sheer survival. I'm a solutions-oriented optimist, which at times can provide its own set of challenges. But over the past week, professionally and personally, literally and figuratively, I have seen circumstances appear that indicate the sun isn't always going to rise as advertised. The change can come about so fast and without warning that it can and will devastate you where you stand. And no matter what you think you have prepared for, there are always changes that you never anticipated, which is why you need to prepare, as best you can, for the things you can anticipate, because it's the things you can't anticipate that ultimately will test your resolve and ability to survive and adapt to change. Last week, the sun did not rise for someone for whom I hold a great professional respect. Dr. Nathaniel Brandon, a pioneering psychologist known as the father of the modern self-esteem movement, passed away. Early in his career in the 1950s and 60s, he was an associate of both Ayn Rand and former Fed chairman Alan Greenspan, whom I have discussed many times on this broadcast. I became interested in Brandon's work in 1991 when I attended a less-than-objective objectivists conference discussing the works of Rand, Greenspan, and other economic thinkers at that time. The original edition of Atlas Shrugged, a book once voted second most influential in people's lives next to the Bible, was dedicated in part to Brandon. At the conference I attended, I was intrigued how a group of extremely rational thinkers could be so unobjective when it came to discussing, or should I say, excommunicating from discussion, someone who played a major role in a book and movement that was credited by many with the development of at least the positive side of Reaganomics and other initiatives of the 1980s. I met Brandon several months later and continued to devour all of his cutting-edge publications and lectures throughout the 90s. In 2000 and 2001, I retained him as a professional coach to work with me on repositioning the focus and message of my speaking business to conquering change. One of the brightest intellectual lights of the past century was extinguished last week. Most will never realize the full impact of how his works and ideas have penetrated business, education, philosophy, and the global psyche at large. Probably my favorite quote from all of his writings, which relates to what we discuss each week on Goldseek, is, "Of all the judgments we pass in life, none is as important as the one we pass upon ourselves." What you think about yourself, your ideas, and your beliefs, when few others identify, agree, or understand, is a judgment that creates the confidence to think outside the box, to think unconventional thoughts, to innovate and lead. That ability is the ultimate survival skill. Because as the global economic crisis mounts itself for a repeat of 2008, there are going to be many unanticipated changes we must all deal with, especially when it becomes clear that the sun isn't always going to rise as advertised. For many, the sun hasn't risen since 2008 and 2009. But for the 75% to 80% of workers of working age who still have jobs, that fact is easy to forget. But not so easy for the 20% to 25% without jobs or have stopped looking. Too many people look at the economy today and believe the low unemployment and inflation numbers. They forget about all the economic destruction that has occurred since 2008. retirement funds that no longer exist, jobs and industries that no longer exist, the growing challenge between older workers who must continue working and younger workers with expensive educations unable to find employment. A government and Fed whose only solution is some variation of printing the difference, as in growing the debt or else. The danger we face is that to many, the economy, or at least the reports of the economy, appear to be healthy. But underneath, an economic cancer has been growing that most observers, including the patient itself, are unaware even exists. The patient may look healthy on the outside, and then one day the patient coughs. 2 days later gets treated for pneumonia. 5 days later is diagnosed with potential lung cancer and dies 1 week later. That's how fast an end-stage cancer can rear its head in what seems to be an otherwise healthy economy. I know this all too well. For me, the sun did not rise this week. My little dog, Sunny, as in sunshine, a 6.5-year-old miniature Australian shepherd, began to cough 2 weeks ago. She began treatment for suspected pneumonia 2 days later, was diagnosed with lung cancer, and died in my arms 2 days ago. It happened that fast. Unlike the economy, there was no way to see it coming. The pain, the trauma, and the loss are all very real. It's a pain I would not wish on my worst enemy. The next wave of the economic collapse will create a similar pain in millions, tens of millions of people who never saw it coming again. The trauma this will inflict is massive, on par or greater than 2008 or 9/11. The unexpected and sudden loss in the next wave of the economic collapse will cause many to ask what they could have done to anticipate its arrival. In the economic arena, there is much one can do to anticipate this kind of future loss, which can occur suddenly and without warning. We discuss those things each week on Goldseek. On a Jim Rickards interview this week with Greg Hunter, he discussed how the timetable for economic collapse was accelerating. He concluded by saying the next problem will be bigger than the Fed, and the IMF is going to have to bail out the United States. When that happens, the sun isn't going to rise for a lot of folks that day, and perhaps for a long time to come. Like I said, no matter what you think you have prepared for, there are always changes that you never anticipated, which is why you need to prepare as best you can for the things that you can anticipate. Because it's the things you can't anticipate that ultimately will test your resolve and your ability to survive and adapt to change. Are you out of debt? Have you bought gold? Silver? Do you have a plan for dealing with potential crises? If not, why not? Start now. So if the sun does go out, you can begin the process of helping it rise again. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. And give your pet a big hug tonight. Thanks, Chris.